Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So welcome back. We're here for our normal podcast, but we've just been recording a very special edition, Inside the Room, The Brexit Plots, which will be coming out next Thursday on our podcast feed after Easter. And we've been discussing it, George and I, with Michael Gove. We've had a very triggering couple of hours going through all the weeks up to the June 2016 vote. Michael, it looks like you're sort of a bit quaking. It's been tough.
Well, it was undoubtedly the most intense period of my time, our time, in politics.
Do you mean the last 2 hours?
Well, the last 2 hours, we've gone over, thanks to your forensic questioning, the events of that time. And it's like being dragged back onto the battlefield. Now, I, as you know, believe that leaving the European Union was the right thing to do. But I also believe that the referendum battle was one in which many mistakes were made, not least by me. And it's only right in fairness, when we look back at that time, that you have the chance to remind me of some of the missteps as well as some of the consequences.
Yeah, I think people are going to really enjoy the episodes we've just recorded. I mean, Michael, actually, he compares this to being taken back to Vietnam. And it was pretty traumatic for me going through it all as well over the last couple of hours. But people are going to have to wait for that next week. And Michael's got to leave. He's got a country to run.
Although while he's here, I mean, George says the election is going to be November. Some people are saying July. What do you reckon? Just between us.
Between us, I think November the 14th or the 21st.
Do you?
Oh my God, I said November the 14th. Well, there
How
you go.
How about that?
I have no inside knowledge
but
at all.
But you've just been to see the Prime Minister today.
We did not discuss the election. We were discussing policy.
It's November, George.
Well, I thought it was November the 14th. And one of the people whose political acumen I rate most highly is Michael Gove. And by the way, there's no way Rishi Sunak told Michael Gove when
of
he was playing
not. To have the I don't election. Think the decision has yet been taken.
I know, because he'd tell us.
I can tell you that.
Exactly. If he had told me, I couldn't tell you.
As you just did.
Yeah.
So therefore, the fact that I've told you what I think is proof that I don't know.
Right. Michael, we really hope you enjoy Inside the Room. And we're going to get on with our podcast and let you go. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us.
This is Political Currency.
With Ed Balls and George Osborne.
So I think a member of the cabinet has just agreed with me that the election is going to be on November the 14th, although he just give himself the out, it might be a week later, November the 21st. But that's pretty interesting news, isn't it?
George, I'm afraid, though, you know, given we were discussing elections with Michael Gove, I have got to do a little bit of a point of order style correction. On EMQs, you were saying it's a good thing to choose a fixed election date. But last week on the podcast, you were saying that if they'd stuck with the Fixed Term Parliament Act, then they could have gone to January 2025 because that's the fixed term. I had an email from a very senior media executive who doesn't want to be named, who said, actually, under the Fixed Term Parliament Act, general elections were automatically scheduled for the first Thursday in May of the 5th year after the previous general election, or the 4th year if the date of the previous election was before the first Thursday in May. Given when the 2019 election was, if the act had remained, then the general election following December 2019 would have had to have been on the 2nd of May 2024. So it couldn't have been postponed to January. They'd have had to have it in May.
Well, I do stand corrected. I got that wrong, actually. I remember walking out of the studio thinking I probably got that wrong, because the Fixed Term Parliament Act said you had to have it within 5 years, and January is 5 years, 1 month. The reason why there could technically be a general election now is that Sunak could call it within 5 years in December and you'd still have the campaign. I'm not sure I agree entirely with the media executive here, because in the world in which the Fixed Term Parliament Act had existed and not been repealed, then the last general election wouldn't have been in December, would it?
But he says the fact that there'd been a December election didn't reset the clock to December-January elections, and it would have had to have been May. You know, to be honest, if somebody tell us the truth about this, then we can report it on EMQs or next time.
I should know, since I wrote it on a piece of paper in the middle of the coalition negotiations myself.
But I think if you're Rishi Sunak, would you rather have had the Fixed Term Act and have to have the election in May, or would you be thinking, it's great, I can wait to July or November?
Well, I think generally it would be better for him if there was not a lot of speculation about the election. So I don't think, unfortunately, his cabinet minister, Michael Gove, has helped, because he's just told us that it's either going to be November the 14th or November the 21st.
I think that was Michael Gove's view rather than necessarily the Prime Minister's view.
Well, I wouldn't, you know, discount Michael Gove as knowing what he's talking about.
Gosh.
Anyway.
Little birdie revealed on the perch.
It was a big birdie sitting on the perch in front of everyone, because he's in our podcast telling us what we, by the way, were saying some weeks ago, that November the 14th remains a very likely date for the election. But listen, on this show, we should pick up on that theme of we're going into the Easter recess for Parliament. We've got big local elections coming up. What does that mean for the state of politics, and how do the two parties go into those elections? What shape are they in?
Then we're going to talk about the fact that the BBC is again in the news. Big speech from the Director General, Tim Davey, talking about the future of the BBC, but also speculating a bit about the future of the licence fee as well. And we're going to ask, why is that relationship between the corporation and the government always fraught? And is Tim Davey doing the right thing by raising these issues?
And then we want to mention something that you might have missed in the budget, which is that Jeremy Hunt is launching a British ISA. In other words, you get a special saving allowance if you invest in British companies. Is this a good idea? Is it going to bring money into the British economy? Or is it just the latest in a long list of failed by British campaigns?
Well, we're going to start with the recess. It's Easter weekend, but actually it's not holiday time for members of Parliament, because they'll be going back to join their local election campaigns. We've got local elections in lots of parts of the country, also mayoral elections at the beginning of May. And actually, the expectations game has already begun. I was looking this morning at London Playbook, and the academics, who are the sort of Bible of these things, the Oracle, Colin Rawlings and Michael Thrasher, they said the Tories could lose up to 500 councillors on May the 2nd, which would mean half of all the councillors who are standing. Labour straight out to say nonsense. Apparently, there's a historical trend for governments to perform better at the end of parliaments in general election year, and therefore it'll be a lot less than 500. And the Tories are saying actually 500 losses is optimistic for them, and it could be a lot worse on May the 2nd. So the age-old expectation battle for May the 2nd's already begun.
Yeah, I think we should explain to listeners what we mean by that. Because in politics, until you get to a general election, in which case it doesn't matter what you say you're going to do in the general election, the result is the result, and that affects the way the country's governed for the subsequent years. All these other things like local elections, mayoral elections, by-elections, is all about expectation management. You know, did you do better than you were expected to do? So you can still do badly, but if you've managed to persuade people it's not as bad as everyone thought you were going to do, you can come out of the night in pretty good shape. I mean, the most famous example of this in my political lifetime was, well, not even my political lifetime, it was when I was at university, was the party chairman Ken Baker, Margaret Thatcher's party chairman, saying, you know, the Tories would do really well in some London elections if they held on to Westminster and Wandsworth Council. And the fact that they were only aiming to hold two of the 30-odd councils and that they succeeded, you know, was overlooked in the fact that they'd actually achieved what they set out to achieve. So here, you know, you've got this expectation game going on, as you say, with, you know, Labour saying, no, the Tories are going to do quite well, knowing full well they're not. And the Tories saying, we're going to do absolutely terribly. I have to say, possibly when the Tories are doing this, they're thinking, well, that might just be true because we don't really know where the bottom is on this election.
It's such a funny thing to do, isn't it? I mean, you know, if it's a football match and you did your pre-match press conference and you were the manager and you said, guys, we're going to get absolutely trounced, we're going to lose 10-0, we're rubbish, you know, it wouldn't kind of be motivational.
Well, of course, the councillors listening to this show and perhaps some of the mayors or potential mayors will be absolutely furious with this conversation, and they're furious at the national politicians for having this kind of conversation because, you know, they do a very important job, councils and who runs the, you know, the London Authority and who's the mayor of the West Midlands. These things matter.
And they want to win their seats.
They want to win their seats. And they become kind of, at this point, pawns in the national political game.
It's also the case, isn't it, always, that if you are the incumbent government, then your biggest enemy on local election day or your biggest kind of thorn in your side is the councillors on your own side. You know, when Labour was in government and I would go to the local count, the Labour councillors, if they'd lost their seats, would be saying, it's your fault, it's you guys. They wouldn't care about the Tories. They'd say, it's you who lost us our seats. It's kind of a blue on blue or red on red moment.
It is, and the councillors feel, probably quite rightly, that the kind of national political squabbling in their parties costs them their jobs and the things they're passionate about for their local communities. It also, you should say, there's not just an impact on who actually runs your local area and runs social services or picks up the bins or whatever. For the parties themselves, you know, the councillors are often the most motivated activists. I mean, you see this particularly in the Liberal Democrats, but it's true now in the Labour and Conservative parties. And so, you know, if the Conservative parties do lose half of their councillors up for election, that does decimate their activist force as they approach the election. You know, it's interesting. I think local elections do set the tone for the year in a way that's probably underestimated generally in politics. I always used to think if you'd done well in the local elections or better than people expected, that kind of sets you up for the rest of the year, or at least sets you up to your party conference, which is the next kind of reset moment.
So what do you think for the local and the mayoral elections? What are the real tests that we should be setting, which will judge whether the Conservatives are doing a bit better than they hoped or a bit worse, whether Labour's doing a bit better or a bit worse? Because, as you said, most of these councils are already Labour-controlled. So you aren't going to see very many switches of control on the day.
Look, I think if the Tories only lose half their seats, they'll actually be quite happy. I know that sounds a strange thing to say, but they've got basically 1,000 councillors standing for election, and if 500 lose their seats, that sounds terrible, but it's basically a repetition of last year's result. And it shows that the opinion polls that currently put the Tories on kind of 17, 18, 19, 20% of the vote, there are only a few of those opinion polls, are wrong. You know, the Tory vote is more like 30%. And that's still bad. It's still heading for an election defeat, but it's not catastrophic. And then I think on the night and the day after, the thing to watch will, because they're the things that people get their heads around, are the big mayoral contests. You know, if the Conservatives...
We should say it's Greater Manchester, Liverpool City Region, north of Tyne, Tees Valley, West Midlands and West Yorkshire have all got combined authority mayoral elections. There's also city mayoral elections in Liverpool, Salford and, of course, London, and also the Police and Crime Commissioner elections, although I don't think that they will be noticed in the same way. Of those, it's probably the West Midlands and Teesside, yeah, which will get the attention.
Yeah, so first of all, I should say I'm very proud about these mayoral elections because I was one of the people instrumental in creating them. And I think it's fantastic that we focus on them now in the way that we do. The two contests to look at, we'll come on to London because I think that's slightly separate, are the West Midlands and Teesside.
Which the Tories should win both.
So these are two Tory mayors, Andy Street in the West Midlands and Ben Houchen in Teesside. And it was their victories in 2017 that persuaded Theresa May to go for that
early election.
Of course.
And I remember when we created these mayoral authorities, there was a big internal Tory argument. By the way, Theresa May was one of the cabinet ministers making this point, which is there'll never be Tories running these areas. And it's been a real tribute to both Andy and Ben that they have done successfully in those areas. But if they lose, or one of them loses, and I guess probably Ben Houchen is the most exposed in Teesside, the Tory party has set a lot of stall by them being successful locally. And if one of them or both of them loses, I think that will be a real blow.
It's interesting. With Andy Street, he is a Conservative, but a business person, and I think probably got quite a wide personal following. And
He used to run John Lewis, for people who don't know him. And he's been very critical, by the way. He was the leading opponent of the cancelling of HS2 and very critical of Rishi Sunak doing that.
But if the vote went with national opinion polls, I guess he would lose.
Certainly, if the Tories are really polling less than 20% or around 20%, yes, then you would expect him to lose. So can his personal vote sustain him? I mean,
I think Labour thinks he'll win.
I'll be completely biased here, which is I think it would be a very good thing for the West Midlands if Andy Street continues to be the mayor, because I just think he's a business person who's not that political and is doing his best to bring investment into the area.
And then, of course, with Ben Houchen, there's been all of this kind of reported scandal about the sale of land and kind of shenanigans going on. And I guess the question is, does that impact upon his vote?
Well, Teesside, of course, is one of these really interesting areas that when you and I were kind of active in politics, it would have been, frankly, inconceivable that it was a Tory area rather than the Labour area. I mean, there's a history, by the way, of Tory. You know, Harold Macmillan was the MP for Stockton many, many decades ago. So it's not that there's no Tory support there, but it certainly felt like a Labour heartland when I was Chancellor. And it's been one of the big shifts in British politics, Teesside now as a Conservative mayor. Interesting, it'll be the kind of sign of whether the red wall is going back to red if Ben Houchen loses.
And then, as you said, London.
Well, the interesting thing is they've changed the electoral system in London, the government, to actually make it easier for the Conservatives to win. Because it used to be that there were first and second preferences, and so people who tended to vote Liberal Democrat and Green, certainly in recent years, their second vote would be for Labour, and so the Labour mayor would do well. Didn't stop, you know, Boris Johnson winning as a Tory mayor twice, but the system was generally sort of rigged towards the left. Now you've got the system rigged more in the kind of way a general election constituency is, which is first past the post. So whoever gets the most votes wins. That should make Sadiq Khan much more vulnerable. But, you know, he, I think, has a sort of 25-point poll lead or something. So I don't think anyone's expecting him to get defeated on the night. If he were to be defeated, it would be, of course, a huge shock to people's expectations and assumptions about the general election to come.
It definitely would. What happened, though, was that the Tories got into a real mess, didn't they, over the selection of their candidate? And there was supposed to be a Downing Street, a Daniel Korsky, who was supposed to get the nomination, and then things went wrong for him. He ended up in a scandal and pulled out, and they ended up with an idiosyncratic candidate.
Well, that's one way of calling Susan Hall. I
mean, here... Well, how would you call her, then?
Not well known enough, I think would be the polite way of putting it. I think the question here is, could the Tories ever win this contest in the current circumstances, the current national backdrop? And the truth is, I think they possibly could, because there's quite a high degree of dissatisfaction with the way Sadiq Khan has performed on some issues like knife crime and housing and homelessness. And, you know, a majority of Londoners are not happy with his performance. Obviously, he would argue it's not entirely his fault. And, you know, I'm not going to get into all that. But, you know, I think
he was out today attacking the government on housing numbers.
Right. So I think he would have been potentially vulnerable. I kind of asked the question, why was not more effort made by Conservative Central Office and Downing Street to find a more high-profile candidate? David Cameron.
Well-known, served in big office.
Well, David.
Lived in the capital. You know, always looking for another job.
I don't know who you're talking about. Much as I love the city, I also love this podcaster. why would I give up our little studio in Shoreditch for swanky City Hall?
Let's be honest, it's the other jobs you'd have to give up as well, which would cause a bit of grief too.
So we come back to this question, which is David Cameron and I spent a lot of time trying to find the right candidate to run for London and, you know, persuaded Boris Johnson to run, because we absolutely thought not only that would be good for him, but it would be very good for us if we won and that he had the profile to win. And he turned out he did, of course. And by the way, begs all sorts of other questions, you know, about what if we hadn't persuaded Boris to be the mayor of London. And I find it just a bit odd that more effort has not been put into this? Because if you're Sunak, you are looking at the moment, and this would have been clear a year ago when this process started, you are looking for what are the opportunities I've got to completely reset things. And the London mayoral contest, you would have thought, Sadiq Khan is actually more vulnerable than he looks. We could run a very good campaign on crime and the like. The first past the post system does open up the chance of defeating him. And if we have the right candidate who perhaps is not kind of totally identified with the Conservatives in the way that Andy Street isn't in the West Midlands and builds up a kind of personal vote, we could win this. And if we won this, my God, we would send a shockwave through those expectations about the general election.
And instead, Susan Hall, puts out a video this week from the campaign, would have been sanctioned by the upper echelons of the Conservative Party, claiming that London is now a crime capital. And it turns out that the footage was not even of London, it was of New York.
I think we can hear the video now, can't we?
Can we?
A 54% increase in knife crime since the Labour mayor seized power has the metropolis teetering on the brink of chaos. And in the chaos, people seek a desperate reprieve.
Well, I think there's a clue that maybe the footage was from New York because they seem to have used an American to do the voiceover.
It's amazing. I remember being at Mar-a-Lago, I may have said this before, and having a Trump supporter saying to me at Mar-a-Lago, "Are you from London? Aren't there Muslim no-go areas there?" But of course, that was what Trump was telling people. There's parts of London you daren't go. I mean, it's one thing for that to be Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago, but Susan Hall, the Conservative candidate, talking down London in that way, amazing.
But you see, I'm afraid, Ed, you've fallen into my cunning trap because we've just played that video and therefore our huge numbers of listeners to this podcast would have heard it. And I know what the Tories are saying at the moment. We don't mind the controversy because it means that thousands and thousands of people are clicking on to listen to the video.
So thousands, tens, you are hundreds, millions of people turning on to our podcast.
You turn out to be an agent of Susan Hall's ambitions.
And of course, the other thing is that Lee Anderson, before he was chucked out of the Conservative Party and went to Reform, was the person who was targeting Sadiq Khan, the guy who was in hoc to Muslim extremists. And with this kind of ad, is the target here really Londoners, or is the target is as much Red Wall voters outside of London who the Conservatives are trying to tap into?
I think they'd be trying some of the tactics they'll maybe thinking of for the general election. The kind of complaint from the Susan Hall campaign is they're not getting enough support from the Conservative HQ, that the Conservative HQ has sort of given up on the election.
So they're having to make their own videos.
Well, I think she claims this one came from Campaign Central.
Right.
But we should probably at some other point discuss, is it okay if your ad is kind of criticized and, you know, people think it's extreme or whatever? Does it still do the job because everyone's talking about it? You know, it's all publicity, good publicity on negative campaigning.
It depends in the end whether it reinforces what people already believe. And that is, of course, the question about the attack on crime in London. And we'll see on polling day whether this lands.
Yeah. I mean, there's a kind of broader question, which is, you know, there's no doubt that the local elections have loomed large over the Sunak premiership. And a lot of the discussion around whether, you know, he should be replaced as leader have sort of centered on, you know, how is he going to do in these local elections? And if they're a real bloodbath, you know, what's going to happen afterwards? So perhaps we should just touch on what's the state of the parties going into these local elections. Because equally, if Keir Starmer doesn't, you know, sweep the board as Tony Blair did in 1996 and win in the West Midlands and win in Teesside, which were areas that Labour did incredibly strongly in the last time they captured high office, there'll be kind of doubts about, well, maybe the Starmer effect is not really being felt out there. It's all an anti-Tory vote, but when people are actually faced with a choice, you know, they're not coming to Labour's side. So let's start with Labour. We've just been talking about the Tories. What would you say, Ed, of the kind of state of Labour going into these local elections? And what's the mood and presumably quite a lot of excitement about potentially being in government by the end of the year? Is it turning into complacency?
I wouldn't say it's turning into complacency. I think there will be nervousness because I think for Labour, the election coming sooner rather than later would be much better. What you don't want to do is just to allow there to be some kind of wobble or kind of deviation from the path a mistake made. I reckon they'll be feeling quite upbeat going into Easter. The polls have not been moved by the budget. There's some big fiscal challenges for Labour to sort out, but they're not under immediate pressure to sort them out. Peter Mandelson on Monday, in a very typical Peter Mandelson way, popped up casting some doubt on the New Deal for working people. We talked last week about the changes they're proposing on unfair dismissal and sickness benefit and maternity pay. And he said, you know, got to be careful to consult with business. And I'd said last week that I thought there would be a probationary period, but actually it didn't really land. Didn't really cause a big problem for Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves. And Keir Starmer's been doing quite a lot of soft media, Grazia, mid-morning TV. I would think they're thinking things are going well, but they want the election sooner rather than later, because actually time is not their friend.
There's certainly a view in the Conservative Party that time could be their friend, because it could make the situation even better for them in the Labour Party. Just on the Mandelson intervention, I mean, A, what's he playing at? Does he want to be the kind of friendly critic of the regime, or is he... Or did he just sort of misspeak and, you know, he actually wants to be on inside the room and, you know, this is not the way to go about it. Not least after you'd fat-shamed Keir Starmer a couple of weeks ago.
We should get him on inside the room. There's so many different periods which we could pick over.
There's the bit where he stuffs Gordon Brown, isn't there, in 1994?
There is that. And there's the bit when then Tony Blair stuffs him by removing him from the cabinet more than once. There's so many things.
Well, there's the bit where we both are eating stuffed vine leaves in a Greek taverna. That's a disaster for me.
That is true. In a Greek taverna, you know, before popping back on the launch to the boat. Look, the thing with Peter is, you know, he wants to be on the inside and he will be saying these things in private. And if he doesn't think he's being listened to, then I'll say them in public. And I think that's what he did. And the fact that it then went away probably means he's a bit annoyed. But the truth is that the government's not strong this week. Business organisations aren't strong. And Peter kind of will think that he was playing a public service by warning Labour to be careful on this, but guess it didn't really land. Mm. How about the Conservatives? What's their mood going into Easter?
Well, I think the mood is quite grim. The budget landed well. I think there was a feeling that at last we're talking about the economy. There's some polling evidence that on economic competence, the Tories are ticking up. And, you know, we've discussed on this podcast many times that that, to my mind, is the battleground that they can win on, or the only battleground they can win on. But then a couple of things happened this week, which I think, again, knocked them back. The first was this kind of mini reshuffle. So two long-standing MPs, Robert Halfon, who I know really well, is a friend of mine, was my PPS. He's the MP for Harlow. And if you've been in the House of Commons any point in the last 20 years, you would know he's the MP for Harlow, because he talks a lot about Harlow.
He does.
And, you know, he's a wonderful...
And cutting fuel duty.
He's one of the most expensive MPs in history.
One of my allies.
Yes. And then I brought him inside my tent. Yeah, so he's stepping down. And James Heapy was the Armed Forces Minister, an ex-soldier in the West Country. I mean, frankly, they're both stepping down because they think they're going to lose their seats, I'm sure. I haven't spoken to them, so that's not me reporting private conversations. But they're both, in the case of James, a Liberal Democrat facing seat, in the case of Robert, an absolute classic Labour fight on the outskirts of London. So they join a kind of crowd of people departing, and causes Sunak to have a little mini reshuffle, in which he makes a very interesting appointment. He sort of doubles down on his Lee Anderson strategy. So Lee Anderson's left. He was the outspoken deputy chairman who then defected to Reform after being fired. And there's an MP called Jonathan Gullis, who is very plain-spoken, Brexity, and not afraid to say it as it is, at least in his mind, who's been made the deputy chairman. He immediately went out and started attacking Labour in the West Midlands, saying, if you go woke, you go broke, which I thought was actually quite a good slogan.
How many weeks to give him?
Well, yeah, of course, the trouble with him is, you know, Sunak again is trying to manage the party and risking just in a few weeks' time, Jonathan's going to say something that Sunak's going to have to suspend him over again, and then maybe, you know. So he's taking a risk at that. But it's more that if people like Robert Halfon are going, it feels like a bit of an end of an era. And then second, the thing that I think would have sent a real shockwave through the Tories again this week was the Professor Curtis, who's the great polling guru who we all turn to, and anyone who listens to the Today programme will have heard many times, saying that the Tories had a 1% chance of winning the next general election, or 1% chance of there being a Conservative Prime Minister after the election, because even in a hung parliament, they've got no one they can do a deal with. And for those who know John Curtis, I have to say, by the way, his daughter was my private secretary in the Treasury, Ruth, and she was exceptionally capable civil servant. So I always have a bit of a, you know, a fondness for the Curtis family. And, you know, John Curtis is not a man given to extremes and, you know...
Is he right 99% of the time?
Well, the thing about being 99% right is you're never sure when the 1% is going to be. Do you?
That is true. So are you still thinking November for the election? And are you still thinking that the Conservative Prime Ministerial candidate will be Rishi Sunak?
Yes and yes. There is talk of July, a July election. They're definitely, again, considering it in Downing Street, but I think it's a bit like the May election. You know, you can sort of think about it. And I remember in the run-up to 1997, when I worked in Downing Street, there was lots of talk of, like, maybe we'll have a May election, maybe we'll have a summer election. And, of course, you know, the reality dawns, you can't possibly have a... All I'd say, you know, if they're not going to have a July election, they should definitely rule it out now, because they allowed the May election speculation to run for far too long.
And how about this Tim Montgomery speculation, you know, senior Conservative figure saying that he was being told that people were hearing Rishi Sunak within Downing Street saying, you know, well, if I'm not the right guy, if I'm not the right person, maybe I should stand aside. All nonsense?
It may not be nonsense, but I can't believe that, you know, Sunak is saying it to people who are repeating it outside. You know, if he does have those doubts, then they would be confined to his very, very closest aides and friends.
And do you know a politician who's gone through their career and not had doubts? Don't you think everybody in that core asks those questions of themselves?
Yes, of course, if you were the Prime Minister in this situation, you know, you would be wondering, like, what can I possibly do? Am I getting something wrong? I mean, I think the mood, you know, has been quite depressing at the centre of the Conservative Party because all the different things they've been trying haven't worked. You know, I would suggest to them just try something and stick at it and be more consistent, and it might well work. And the budget, you know, was a good example of that. Anyway, one thing that's going to be a constant in this election is that people are going to turn to the BBC for some of their political news during it. Although I say this, of course, facing an ITV presenter.
An ITV presenter who's, you know, has a lot of respect for the BBC, of course. And we'll talk about that after the break.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back. So this week, the Director General of the BBC, Tim Davey, gave a big speech to the Royal Television Society, setting out the future of the BBC. And the thing that caught the headlines was that he acknowledged that there had to be a debate about the future of the licence fee, right? That's the 159 quid we all pay as households to access the BBC every year. But actually, if you read the speech, it's a good speech, and there's a whole load of other things in it about the role of the BBC in the future, why it's as important, he would argue, to a cohesive society today as it ever has been. And there's a whole interesting bit about technology, and he talks about the BBC developing what he says is an ethical algorithm as it becomes more and more digital, that rather than polarizing people as some of the commercial algorithms of the big social media companies, he argues, does, in fact, brings the country together and exposes people to diverse opinions. And that's quite a kind of interesting challenge to us as a society, which is, how do we want, you know, the technology that guides our lives to be in private hands, or do we want some kind of public balance? So it was a good speech. I guess it sort of has thrown up a couple of questions, which is, you know, what is the BBC's future in a world where, let's imagine, there's a Labour government? And indeed, what's it been under the Conservatives? And in the row about it, is the row about its funding and its future sort of unique to this time, or is this something the BBC has lived with all its life?
Well, it's certainly lived all its life with criticism from politicians. I mean, if you go back to Churchill complaining that the BBC wasn't sufficiently supportive during the Second World War, Eden saying, why aren't they supporting me on Suez? Wilson having rows with the BBC, Margaret Thatcher, of course, Tony Blair in the Iraq War. It's always the case that the government of the day is agitating about the BBC. But that's because the BBC has this view, which as a public service is going to be impartial. And there is always an argument and a debate about what that impartiality is all about.
Can I ask you, Ed, because I don't think I've ever asked you this. How did you feel, you know, you were working in government with Gordon, and so you weren't really part of this, but the kind of Blairite assault on the BBC at the time of the Iraq War, which basically forced out the, or the aftermath of the Iraq War, when, remember, the BBC had run a report that that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which ultimately turned out to be true. But, you know, there are lots of criticisms about the way the report was put together. It felt quite bullying behaviour by Downing Street, didn't it? And it did force out, actually, a Labour-leaning director general and chair of the BBC. But were the kind of Brownites just on the sidelines for that battle?
They were on the sidelines, but I think didn't like what was happening. And, you know, I've always thought that politics has to, you know, push up against the BBC, because you've always got to challenge its judgments, but fundamentally respect its public service remit, its objectivity and its independence. And I think you can go too far. I didn't like the scale of cuts that you drove through with the BBC when you were Chancellor. I didn't like the rows Tony Blair had at that time. I remember a particular moment. It was when I was the Economic Secretary, and this leak occurs of a report which had been done by John Redwood on deregulation for you and for David Cameron. And they were testing the website, and they put a trial version of the document up. But we were kind of on it, and we had somebody who was every minute refreshing, and we got this document, and it was a leak, and it had all this sort of, you know, stripping away of employment regulation, deregulate the City of London. And we had the document, and we dashed straight off to Millbank, to the BBC, with somebody ringing to say, we've got this leak, you know, the true agenda of Cameron and Osborne exposed. And we were straight onto Sky, and actually straight onto ITV at the time. And the BBC said, well, thank you, we'll look at this carefully, we'll need to check our sources, we're not going to report this straight away. And we're saying, I know, but you're behind Sky. And they said, well, I know, but we're the BBC. And it was a bit annoying, but that's what the BBC does. What the BBC does is it, on our behalf, applies proper checks and objectivity and balance and fairness. And I was annoyed that day. Tony Blair was clearly annoyed in a much bigger way. You were probably annoyed at times, but that's what the BBC does. And I just sort of feel as though in this world, I mean, what an advantage we have to have both a BBC, but also to have regulated public broadcasters who all the time are being judged and checked for balance and fairness. And it's something that you think about all the time as an ITV broadcaster as well. And
but is it being overwhelmed by the modern world? I mean, this is obviously what Tim Davie was addressing. And he, by the way, talked about the BBC's role in pursuing truth with no agenda. I mean, obviously, both on the left and the right, people have disputed that they don't have an agenda or a hidden agenda, or that there's not a kind of bias, a sort of metropolitan bias in the way they approach things. But of course, there were other things the BBC done. You know, we grew up in a world where if you wanted to watch sport, you turned on Grandstand when we were kids. And if you want to watch anything on television, you know, drama or light entertainment, you went to the BBC. We obviously now live in a world where a lot of those things are provided elsewhere, either by the kind of Netflix or and Apples of this world, or in the case of sport many decades ago by Sky. So are we overly relying on the BBC just being a kind of news service, or is that just because we're politicians, we're interested in that aspect? Because, well, I think Davey's trying to make the case for the BBC across the board as a broadcaster, not just as a news service.
And interestingly, in the speech, when I went into the speech thinking, has he made a speech about the license fee? And I was quite nervous about that, because in the end, that's a political decision. And of course, the BBC wants to lead this and be part of this debate. But in the end, to open this thin end of what could be quite a thick wedge was quite risky. When you actually read the speech, it was mainly about the BBC as guardian of impartiality, the BBC as contributor to the regional balance of our economy. And they've done some really important things on regional balance and investment in northern production. Also, as you say, was talking about how they respond to the changing landscape while keeping a focus on the public service part of their remit. The one thing he said, which I also, by the way, totally agreed with, was that the decision, which I think you made, to shift the funding of the World Service from the government to the BBC was, you know, an extra burden they didn't need to take on. Every year, we always made sure, when I was at the Treasury, that we generously, in the spending review, funded the World Service, partly because it was the right thing to do and partly because it really annoyed the Foreign Office.
Yeah,
you had to pay for it.
And we know the Treasury's number one objective most of the time is to annoy the Foreign
number
Office.
Number two. Number one was to serve the public interest.
Yeah. No, number one was to have a row with the Bank of England. So, look, I did two licence fee settlements as Chancellor, one in 2010 and one after the election in 2015. And in the first one, the kind of controversial decision we made was to get the BBC to fund the World Service, which was a way of delivering a public expenditure cut in the Foreign Office budget. And then in 2015, we got the BBC to take on the cost of providing free TV licences to pensioners.
Which they should never have agreed to.
Well, I think
what were they doing?
Well, I think, to be fair to Tony Hall, he didn't have much room for manoeuvre. It was a majority Conservative government. And I think he's got unfair blame because one of the things that actually somewhat shocked.
Because you should be blamed.
Well, I certainly should be accountable for it. And I'm very happy to argue why. You know, it's completely right that the license fee should reflect the fact that large numbers of people aren't paying for it. And, you know, if you want to. And I thought it was also important for the BBC to internalise some of the challenges that we have as a government in trying to make the sums add up. You know, you never heard on the BBC anyone say anything other than free license fees for pensioners were a great thing. But I wanted to make a slightly different point, which is I was somewhat shocked and surprised, even though I've been shadow chancellor, and how much power the Chancellor Exchequer has over the BBC. So you think of the BBC as being this kind of big independent organisation, lots of kind of protection against the government of the day, even if they have rows about, you know, particular programmes. But the Chancellor can basically boss the BBC around on its finances because the government sets the licence fee in the charter. And I thought Tony Hall got too much stick in 2015, because I didn't think he had that much room for manoeuvre, and we were very determined to achieve certain things. By the way, we gave the BBC in return other things that they wanted, like, for example, the rule that you had to have a licence fee if you access the iPlayer, which was really crucial for the BBC's future. But in 2010, under Mark Thompson, the Director General, I actually think the BBC were too slow to realise that in a coalition they could have gone to the Liberal Democrats and caused me quite a lot of trouble by stirring up Liberal Democrat opposition to what I was doing. And as a result, potentially rolled over too easily.
What do you think?
I mean, I would say, and this is very easy for me to say with hindsight, so, you know, I don't think actually governments should have that kind of control over the BBC. And, I regret to some degree using that leverage. And I certainly regret, because once I sort of realised how much power that the government had, not using the opportunity to put in place some real protections for the BBC, because I'm a big fan of the BBC.
Do you regret the scale of the cuts?
I don't. I think they, you know, it would have been odd for the public broadcaster to have been protected from cuts at a time.
But they were
when,
massive.
Well, remember, they could have done other things to raise their income. And there was, you know, anyone who's worked in the BBC will tell you there's a ton of bureaucracy, right? And there are many layers of management. So, you know, they should be, this is public money, and it's essentially, you know, a compulsory tax on people, the licence fee. And like anything else which we require people to pay taxes for, there should be scrutiny of how the money is spent and, you know, you should be encouraged to be efficient. I think there's a kind of bigger question, which is, do we need to find alternative ways of bringing money into the BBC, assuming you're not going to be able to increase the licence fee dramatically, whoever's the government?
Without undercutting the commercial operators who rely upon advertising.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, Davy announced this week, didn't get much attention, but I tell you, will be noticed in all sorts of newsrooms and organisations like Tortoise, which former news editor of the BBC, James Harding, has set up, that the BBC are launching a kind of long-read news digital channel where people are going to be able to get long factual pieces, and it's going to feel much more like a kind of newspaper or some of these other rival commercial.
Potentially with advertising to pay for.
Yeah. So, you know, the trouble with the BBC is it's both too small when you compare it against Apple and Netflix. It's now tiny when it's commissioning budget. And yet it's too big when you put it against some of the domestic newspapers or the commercial radio stations. And it's sort of stuck in the middle somewhat. But I think where we all agree is that it's a huge national asset. And I don't like conservatives who go around just bashing the BBC for the sake of it. I mean, this is what Nadine Dorries was going around saying when she was the minister in charge of the BBC.
I want to see from organisations like the BBC what they're going to do to change. It's just about having a more fair approach and a less elitist and a less snobbish approach as to who works for you.
What I always love about Nadine is she complains about elitism, but the reason she resigned from Parliament is she didn't get a seat in the House of Lords. So, but
and her bank account is with?
We discovered is with Coutts, didn't we? Unlike Nigel Farage.
Unlike who who wasn't able to break in. Do you think there'll be any temptation for Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak to sort of play that as part of their woke agenda in the run-up to the manifesto, the anti-BBC card? If I had to guess, I would say Labour will not be restoring any of the cuts to BBC funding in the next Parliament, but they also will want to carry on supporting funding the current BBC model, including the licence fee, and won't really want to get into any of the Davy ideas about means testing or anything.
Yeah, actually, I think it's interesting that in an election year, both Sunak and Hunt have allowed the licence fee to go up with inflation and quite a hefty inflation increase of £10 in the licence fee. So, you know, they haven't played the we're going to freeze the licence fee and punish the BBC card. And of course, they also backed off privatising Channel 4, which was the kind of Nadine Dorries, Boris Johnson agenda. So, you know, they're quite centrist Tories at the centre of the government at the moment. And I think a war with the BBC is probably not on their cards for the next 6 months.
So they'll have welcomed his speech.
Well, Tim Davey, of course, was briefly a Conservative activist, I think.
Councillor
or something. Anyway, you know, I think to be fair to Tim, he's, you know, he's in the centre and probably would have called himself a Blairite at one point and so on. But yeah, I think they would have welcomed a lot of what he said. But it's, you know, he poses big questions, which, you know, in the end, the political parties are kind of scratching around the edges of, which is what is the future of this great institution in a world of these big streaming giants? And as he says, do we want to have all of our news provided by American and Chinese tech companies? Interesting, he doesn't really differentiate between the two. Or do we want something that's uniquely British? And if we do want something uniquely British, then the next government is going to have to do some pretty hard thinking about how it supports the BBC.
I think that's right. But the important thing is it's a choice, and it's a choice about the future of a public service. And it's a public service which for 100 years has been an important part of being British. And I hope that will carry on. So the thing that you might have missed this week, we're just getting to the end of the financial year, the year in which you can save into your ISA. People can save up to £20,000. But in the budget, Jeremy Hunt started a consultation for a new extra ISA. Not exactly sure what they're planning to do, but the consultation runs until the summer for the British ISA, where you can save an extra £5,000. That's over the £20,000 you can currently save in your ISA. £5,000 more, but it's got to be in British equities. It's not clear whether that will include British gilts yet, but it will be set up so you can save in British equity shares.
And by the way, gilts, for those, you know, who aren't familiar with Ed's technical terms, are government bonds. But let's hear from Jeremy Hunt in the budget.
After a consultation on its implementation, I will introduce a brand new British ISA, which will allow an additional £5,000 annual investment for investments in UK equity with all the tax advantages of other ISAs. And this will be on top of the existing ISA allowances, ensure British savers can benefit from the growth of the most promising UK businesses, as well as supporting those businesses with the capital to expand.
So I jacked up the ISA allowance to £20,000, but it's actually been frozen ever since under all the chancellors who've come after me. And I would say the ISA introduced 20, 30 years ago has been a spectacularly successful policy because it's...
Originally the TESA,
yes,
introduced by John Major, and then we changed it to the ISA in 1997, 98, I think.
And it's really worked. I mean, people know what it is, and there have been lots of other attempts to get people to save, but this one has really succeeded. And this is a kind of new avenue, isn't it? Because until now, people have been able to save up to £20,000, which obviously for most people is a huge amount of money to save out of their income every year, tax-free. And we've been kind of basically neutral about where you put the money. If you want to invest in Britain, fine. If you want to invest in American companies, you can do that. If you want to invest on the Chinese stock market through the ICO, you can do that. We haven't been prescriptive about it on the grounds that, you know, if people think they can make money out of these things, that's good for them and their savings. This is the first time the ISA is being used as a kind of instrument of sort of national economic industrial policy, as opposed to just helping people save. And I know that inside the Treasury and more broadly in the city, there's been quite a lot of suspicion. Not, I wouldn't say outright hostility, because in the end, it's not such a big deal. But Hunter's really pushed this through, and it's his kind of personal baby.
When there's two different criticisms. One is it's on top of the 20,000 allowance. And to be honest, to save £20,000 a year already is way off the scale. You know, only the highest earners could afford to put away £20,000 a year. Most people save a fraction of that a year. And so to be able to save, in addition, a further £5,000 means it's not going to be available for the vast majority of people. And then the second question arises, if people are saving, shouldn't they be saving in the place where they get the best returns? And if the best returns is to save in American or European equities, why should we be tax advantaging people to save in something which will be less good for them?
Yeah, I think there's also going to be a kind of complication, which is, okay, so say you can just invest on stocks on the London stock market, London Stock Exchange. Quite a lot of those companies that list on the stock exchange do all their business overseas. You know, so they might be kind of British in the sense they're listed here, but you get, you know, you've got mining companies that mine in Central Asia who sit on the London stock market. So I don't think it will be so straightforward. However, I think it's quite creative and imaginative. I think we should give Hunt some credit for that. And I think there will be, despite all the naysayers, you know, who just want a sort of free-for-all, you know, there will be some benefit, I felt, particularly by kind of mid-cap British companies in the sort of FTSE 250. These aren't the, you know, the BPs and the HSBCs of this world. You know, they will benefit as well. But towards the middle part of the stock market, smaller British companies who have found it harder to raise money. And, you know, there's a kind of general problem with the British economy. This is true of other European economies, that access to capital for companies is much harder than it is in the US, and they often have to go to banks to borrow. If you have deeper equity markets, if you have more investors in those mid-cap British companies, that's got to be a good thing. And yes, okay, your point, there are only going to be some pretty rich people who are going to be able to save £25,000 a year as opposed to just £20,000 a year. But, you know, it'll all add up, and it's extra money into an important engine of the future of the country's growth.
It also taps into a sort of, you know, more a deeper historic kind of political tendency, which is to tell people to buy British or to save British or invest in Britain. It's always been a dilemma for politics as to how far you go down that road. The economist in me is always skeptical and thinks, actually, you know, international trade's good for us and that's the best way to get the best prices, but also to drive dynamism in the economy. But politics says, oh, no, but hang on a sec, we ought to be buying our police cars from Britain. Or, I mean, I think for national security reasons, obviously it makes sense to be procuring your vital national assets from within your own country. But then you get into, you know, consumers. I mean, of course, they quite like to buy British, but, you know,
do you remember
if it's higher quality and cheaper, why would I want to, you know, don't buy a Japanese television, buy a British made one. Most people would say, get off.
You know, you and I will remember that brilliant satirical show, Not the 9 o'clock News, which launched the careers of people like Rowan Atkinson.
Early 1980s.
And at the time, there was a kind of national TV ads around investing in Wales. This was actually a response to things like the coal mines being shut in Wales. And it was all made in Wales, to the theme of Men of Harlech. And they did this advert, which was failed in Wales. They had a list of all the companies that were closing under the Thatcher government. So generally, these Buy British campaigns have not really worked for the reason, as you say, you know, people wanted a Sony television. They didn't want a Grundig television.
There was also a big row in the late 1960s about there was an attempt to sort of do a eat British, buy British, baked beans on toast, kind of completely, you'd think, British meal. American company, Heinz Beans, the beans being and the tomatoes being procured from around the world. I mean, it's always hard to know what is the Britishness of the individual product.
Yeah, I think generally Britain benefits from being a big open trading economy, collecting goods from around the world, sending them around the world, selling our services around the world. So, you know,
like, Rachel Reeve, though, did that, I think, a couple of years ago, a nod to this Buy British idea in one of her conference speeches.
Yeah, I think, and by the way, in her Mace lecture, she also talked about getting British pension funds to invest in Britain, which is another theme of Jeremy Hunt's. I think, you know, what they're both doing is revealing something which is the truth underlying politics at the moment, which is there's no money left. And so if you can get people to put some money in British ISAs, if you can get pension funds to invest in British infrastructure, that's just one less thing that you're asking the Treasury to do. Whether it works, I think it will probably help at the margins, but it's certainly not going to be transformative. I, however, will be taking it up.
Look, we need to bring this to an end because George has got to go and make, you know, one of his global international conference calls. And therefore, we can't hold back the path of global commerce. That's all for this week.
So look, next Monday, Easter Monday, there's not going to be an edition of EMQs because it's a bank holiday here in the UK. But we do have a couple of very special episodes coming on after that around our deep dive into a particular period in British history, and that is the Brexit referendum. So we've got a special set of episodes inside the room, the Brexit plots. And if you were listening to the beginning of this podcast, you will know that our special guest is the chair of the Leave campaign at the time, Michael Gove.
And without giving too much away, we really do go inside the room to the discussions and the arguments and the strategic dilemmas which shaped the Brexit campaign, but also the Remain campaign and all the build-up to that June 2016 vote. I promise you that you're not going to want to miss it. Do make sure you've subscribed or followed wherever you are to get your podcast so that it lands in your feed next Thursday.
Yeah, Remainer or Leaver, political obsessive or just a casual passerby, you will love these episodes. See you next week.
See you then.
This is Political Currency
with Ed Balls and George Osborne.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.